so quickly on modern dating, mainly online dating. It's become so screwy. It's like you don't even know if it's a real person or a scam or whatever, even if you've had a conversation with someone for a while. So whenever I connect with someone, I'm always kind of looking at the way they write, any kind of like weird inconsistencies. Or if a girl is like way too forward at the beginning, then I know it's complete bullshit. So I'd been talking to someone last week off an app, Hinge or whatever, and, you know, there were no weird signs, very legit, and then just kind of disappeared. I'm always waiting for like a scam or something, like, you know, you've been talking to someone for a couple of days and then finally they're like, do you want to invest in Bitcoin? Or my grandmother's in trouble, can you give me some money? It's just kind of disheartening at times. I never let my hopes get up too much when I'm like, you know, trying online dating, but, you know, it's hard to meet people these days. I feel like the internet and phones, it's like weirdly paradoxically made us like harder to meet people. Get me out in public, I'm the life of the party, but, online, I'm still the same nervous, insecure kid like I was in high school. When I text someone, I'm always waiting for the text, and it's just like I don't have a lot of patience. Although at work, I have a lot of patience since I'm a nurse. So let's talk about a new, totally great goddamn movie. A couple more things about nursing school and just some other shit.
You are my density. You are my density.
So I was kind of feeling like absolute garbage after this online dating thing kind of went to crap. So I was like, I'm going to get out of my apartment and I'm going to go see a movie. There's an AMC like right down the street. And holy shit. I mean, I knew I was going to like the movie just because of the description, but what a completely great movie. It's called Love Lies Bleeding. It's directed by the impressive Rose Glass, who also did 2019 Saint Maud, which I started and which I have to check out. But this is kind of a noir thriller with the great Kristen Stewart and Katie Bryan as lovers. Katie Bryan's like a bodybuilder. She comes to this kind of small shithole town that's kind of run by Ed Harris, Kristen Stewart's dad. Kristen Stewart wants to get the hell out of there, but she's kind of just stuck there because, she just wants to take care of her sister who's getting abused by some asshole. And then Ed Harris kind of runs the town. He's like the corrupt kingpin. But it's kind of like, you know, the two girls fall in love. There's some graphic sex, but, you know, it's kind of a beautiful little relationship between them, to be honest. And I read the director had the cast watch the movie Showgirls, the legendary Paul Verhoeven movie with Elizabeth Berkley about strippers and just kind of total debacle, Joe Esterhaz scripted. I mean, there's, you know, it's kind of got a cult following now and it's kind of fun to watch. But I think there's, you know, there's some elements of like a spectacle of that kind of story that's also in Love Lies Bleeding. There's some kind of fantastical sequences. But anyway, it's so well done. I mean, I never was the biggest Kristen Stewart fan for me. I'm not like a Twilight type person. I'm a male and two, I'm too old for that shit. But she is a goddamn revelation in this. I mean, she's so heartfelt, so heartbreaking at times. Katie Bryan is also great in this. And Ed Harris's hairdo has to be seen to be believed. He's like completely bald in the front. But then just only on the sides are like these luxurious fucking Farrah Fawcett locks. I mean, they're just so long. It looks ridiculous, but it totally works. The movie looks great. The ending, like I said, gets a little bizarro, kind of metaphorical or allegorical or something else that ends in ICAL. But man, I fell for it hook, line, and sinker. Please check it out. And the theater is next to a Whole Foods. So after I went to the movie, I was like, I haven't drank for a couple days. I'm going to buy a bottle of wine. And so when I was walking in the front way, there was like a little, you know, desk there in front with a couple guys there. And I'm like, oh, fuck, this is some charity. They're going to ask me for something, you know. And people, they always ask, like, when you're walking in, hey, do you love the environment? Or like, you know, would you like to help starving children? You know, these questions that are like, make you feel like such an asshole if you avoid them or say no. Of course I went to, but, you know, I only have so much money. But anyway, the thing I would often do is act like I'm on my phone. Whenever I see them, like from a, you know, distance, I'll already start talking on my phone. And this is so ridiculous, but I'll almost make the conversation sound very serious. I'll be like, what? She's in the hospital? What? You know, so that the people can literally hear me saying that. And they'll be like, oh, shit, this guy's dealing with something real serious. Let's not even ask him. I think one time I even like, when I was passing by someone, I'm like, what, she died? And then after I bought the wine, I actually walked out the back entrance of Whole Foods and had to walk all the fucking way around to get to my car just to avoid them. I just can't. I'm so sensitive that it's like I don't want to let them down. And it's just like I can't make eye contact or I'll start talking. And then it's like I'm lost. And I give money to homeless people when I can. I try and help people out. But and you can't help everyone. But I still always feel guilty. And quickly, you know, one thing I really hate is when someone says, stop blowing up my phone. It's like, shut the hell up. You're not that important. I texted you like 2 times, maybe 3 times. How about just respond and then we could be done with the whole thing? I mean, I just have a thing. I text back like right away. And when I text someone and they text me back like a week later saying, oh, sorry, I forgot. It's bullshit. You didn't forget. You saw it. You just didn't give a shit. I don't care how busy you are. I mean, I get busy as a nurse. Even if you're the fucking president, you can always text someone back. Takes you 10 seconds. Just be like, hey, I'm super busy. Talk soon. That's how you do it. But you don't just let it sit there. And kind of in the vein of like friends and just kind of losing touch with friends, there's a great article in the New York Times. It's about how we sometimes lose contact with friends. It's called The Friends Who Got Away. It's an editorial. This is kind of a little extended thing from it, but he says, some tweak in your job or living arrangement diminishes your overlap of interests with someone as it lessens or eliminates your routine interactions with that person. And the extra effort necessary to sustain your relationship turns out to be something that one or both of you can't quite manage. You drift ever farther apart until the distance between you is too great to navigate. End of quote. Yeah, it's kind of sad when we lose touch with friends, but it happens. And lately, you know what? I've been kind of like, if I'm always texting someone, they take quite a while to respond, and then they never really check in with me on their own accord. It's like, what's the point? I mean, it's not like I hate this person or anything, but it's just like I just got to let them go. If they reach out at some point, fine, but I can't keep putting energy into like a one-sided thing. I got plenty of real great friends. And yeah, I forgot to mention a couple nursing school and psych job kind of things last week. I was doing my psychology clinical. I knew I was going to love it. And psych nurses are usually really cool or just kind of weird or interesting people just because of the nature of the business. Sometimes you kind of have to be a nut to help a nut. But you really have to help each other on the psych unit. I mean, it's so unpredictable and just sometimes you have to wing it. I always just try and joke with patients a lot just to make them smile, you know, and sometimes or usually it works. Sometimes it doesn't work, but I don't know if I can really trust their reaction, though, because they are a captive audience. Get it? Captive audience, captive in the hospital. But anyway, in the nursing school, psych clinical, the hospital's kind of main psych head honcho was blind, which blew me away on so many levels. First of all, you know, she's walking around this psych unit, which can be dangerous. She's blind with her cane and just navigating that world. But anyway, she would lead these groups and things where like 7 or 8 patients and the 3 nursing students would meet up and we would just kind of sit with each other, you know, talk about what's going on. And it was all led by the head honcho lady. But it was incredible the way she could read people without seeing expressions, just by intuiting so much by listening. And she was always dead on her viewpoint. And that just, she seemed to be so in touch with people. It's like she didn't need vision to know what the hell was going on. I mean, she was like some kind of Marvel superhero. And it was kind of surreal. I remember at the time, me and my girlfriend at nursing school had broken up. It was like a 4 or 5 week, really kind of torrid relationship. Fun while it lasted, but a mess at the end. And I was totally falling apart. We were doing one of the groups and all of us were supposed to say how things were going, something about us, blah, blah, blah. So I had said, you know, hey, I just came here from California to DC/Virginia just to kind of come to nursing school. I don't really know anyone here. I just changed careers. You know, it's kind of daunting. And so in the group, one of the patients who was like severely schizophrenic, he just kind of was talking about himself. And then he also said, you know, hey, I just want to compliment Mark for making that change and going for it. I almost started tearing up a bit, but it was such an insanely human moment. I mean, the fact this homeless schizophrenic guy who's got so much shit going on, so many things to deal with, and he, you know, recognized just a fellow human's pain or whatever, and he said what he said, and it just kind of, it kind of blew me away, and I was like, fuck, I was like, psych nursing is for me. And I'll never forget that patient. And it's funny, another patient in the same clinical, he was a painter, really good painter. He would sit there and really, really joyful dude, kind of a little manic, but he would paint really cool things. And we were talking and we were bullshitting. And I don't know, for some reason, maybe a song was on and we started talking about songs. And we were trying to think of a particular song and we finally came up with it. It was Howard Jones' Things Can Only Get Better. And actually, on my last day on the unit, he painted me a little picture. And I think he wrote, like, you know, from Howard Jones or something like it. But I still have that painting. And yeah, there's just something so weirdly touching or something about, you know, singing, you know, things can only get better on a psych unit. But yeah, here's a little bit of that song.
And do you feel scared? I do, but I won't stop and falter. And if we threw it all away, things can only get better.
But as we all know, things can get worse. But hopefully they don't. And briefly, back on blindness, there's kind of a cool noir mystery called Jennifer 8 from 1992, directed by Bruce Robinson. It has kind of a dull Andy Garcia, to be honest, the ravishing Uma Thurman as a blind woman. And yes, Sir King Grizzle himself, my man Lance Henriksen. It's you know, kind of a thriller murder mystery. Some blind girls have been killed, and Andy Garcia is trying to protect the possible next victim, Uma Thurman. They fall in love, blah, blah, blah. It's not amazing and a tad too long, but it does have a style to it. And if you like any kind of noir mysteries, you'll love this one. And then just a great one, 1993's Blink, directed by the pro Michael Apted, who also directed that fascinating Up series that featured a few people. Like every 7 years, he would go back to them. I think it was in England, and he would like see what's up with them. So from 7, you know, years old to 63 or whatever, every 7 years. Totally fascinating. It's fascinating the way some of the kids, you know, completely stayed in tune with, like, with the way they were later in life. And then some just totally made a switcheroo. But you could just see in, even when they were 7, those little traits, which was totally fascinating. And when you see them as a later, as a grown up person, one poor guy actually, you know, seemed like a troubled kid. And he actually turned out to have like pretty severe mental illness. So that was kind of hard to watch. But anyway, back to Blink. It's a totally fun thriller from 1993 with Aidan Quinn and the ultra-hot Madeline Stowe. Also the super cool kind of legend James Remar. I'll speak more on him later. But yeah, Madeline Stowe is a musician who recently lost most of her sight, and she can only see a little bit, but it's pretty cloudy. So, and she witnesses a murder, but she can't completely remember, you know, she couldn't see him completely. So she just, you know, eventually she kind of gets more of her like memory/sight back, and she's able to remember. But yeah, Aidan Quinn is the cop. They meet, they fall in love, blah, blah, blah. What else is new? Maybe I need to become a cop. That's how I can get a girlfriend. But it's enjoyable, and just in that like 80s to 90s kind of fairly big budget, just good looking, compelling movies. Give me Blink any day over Drive, the 2011 overwrought, overimpressed with itself movie directed by the pretentious Nicholas Winding Refn. Jesus, even his name is pretentious. I mean, Ryan Gosling was good in Drive, but the movie is just fucking phony baloney, arty, just. Didn't do shit for me. Speaking of Gosling, yes, the I'm Just Ken Oscars performance was bordering on genius. I am no Barbie fan, but goddamn, that I'm Just Ken was great. I mean, just well done. Not, didn't take itself seriously. Had fucking Slash from Guns N' Roses in it. I mean, come on. It was super well done. I remember at some psych hospital I was working at, some patient came up to me and he said he wanted fox meat for dinner. And I was like, okay, yeah, okay, buddy, let me see. You know, just thinking he was like cuckoo. I literally Googled fox meat to see, like, is this a thing? And no, it's not. But it finally dawned on my dumb ass that he was trying to say faux, as in like artificial or vegetarian or whatever, which is spelled F-A-U-X. So I get it. He saw that and said fox. But yeah, I understand it. But it was funny, and I'll never forget that moment. And every once in a while, while I'm dining at a fine establishment, I sometimes will ask for fox meat. And you know what? Sometimes they'll get it for me. Tastes like shit. One other moment, there was this one guy who was like a very developmentally disabled, a very simple kid. But he was doing something or other, and it made him happy. And he was smiling, and he literally just like said to us, "Me happy," which is just another one of those like moments or phrases that punch you in the gut. It's like a mixture of sadness, but optimism, but also just surreal kind of. And then lastly, there was some old patient in this hospital I used to work at. He was older. He had some, you know, slight dementia. And me and him kind of bonded. I always really tried to go in there and talk with him and talk with him about things. Not really talk about his problems, just like talk about his past or, you know, what he used to do, what he used to like to do. And so we kind of got along. And anyway, he was walking down the hall once with someone and they pointed at me and said to him, they said, "Hey, there's your friend." And then he kind of came over and looked at me, kind of slowly, startingly said, "He's everybody's friend." Which, yeah, completely tore me apart. It was just one of those, like, knockout moments in life. It's like, it was such a real moment. You can't script that shit. But a lot of moments like that really helped me at work. Like, you know, if something nice happens like that or genuine happens, you know, once a day, then I'm good. And there's actually a pretty cool Sonic Youth song called Schizophrenia from 1987 with both Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon exchanging vocals. I do dig Sonic Youth. They're not like one of my complete favorites, just a little bit bordering on not enough melody for me, but they've got some great songs. And interestingly enough, Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon were a couple while they were in Sonic Youth, and then they broke up, and then Sonic Youth broke up. But they both wrote autobiographies that have come out. Kim Gordon's 2015 Girl in a Band, a memoir, and then Thurston Moore's fairly recent 2023 Sonic Life, a memoir. These indie rock types sure like to use the word memoir, don't they? But anyway, they're just iconic as hell rock figures, and I wish them well. I'm not sure who did each other dirty, or who, you know, screwed over the other. I'm sure one did, but whatever. And speaking of hearing voices, of course, the band Guided by Voices are one of my absolute favorites. I'll get way into them on another music episode. Insanely prolific ex-teacher turned indie rock god Robert Pollard and a rotating bunch of goofballs. I've seen them a bunch. Oh, my God. But anyway, quickly, they have a really cool song, Over the Neptune. It's actually like a combo song, Over the Neptune and Mesh Gear Fox, but I love Over the Neptune. It's from the 1992 Propeller album, and here's a little taste of that. And hey, let's throw the great party today for the rest of our lives. The fun is just about to get started, so throw the switch. It's rock and roll time. Special elixirs flow, and then the onion lady blow a hose. Kisses to the crying cooks with baited hooks and lady looks. Totally great song. And an interesting under-the-radar, well-shot, kind of arty but enjoyable movie is Clean Shaven, directed by Lodge Kerrigan. Starring the kind of legendary, troubled dude, Peter Green, just amazing-looking dude. It's from way back in 1993. Peter Green was famously in The Mask, that movie with Jim Carrey and Cameron Diaz, and also Pulp Fiction. But yeah, it's interestingly shot, kind of puts you in the mindset of a schizophrenic at time. And Peter Green is just kind of devastating in it. Yeah, great performance, and yeah. I was watching some movie the other day. Doesn't sound like me, does it? And someone ordered frog legs for dinner. And then it just kind of hit me. I'm like, I mean, frogs are pretty fucking small. Their legs are real small. It's like, A, can they really be that good? And B, what do they do with the rest of the frog? I mean, is it just like a fucking legless frog sitting there, like miserable for the rest of his life? Got fucking frog crutches or something? I mean, it's like, what do they do with the rest of the frog? Because there's quite a bit of frog left. I mean, yeah, these are the things that keep me up at night. I hope they take the rest of the frog and use it, or, I don't know, send the frog to like a nice place to stay. And if you ever just want to find like instant inspiration or just kind of badassery in general, listen to the amazing Gonna Fly Now, the theme from the movie Rocky by the great Bill Conti. I play this song regularly, and I almost feel euphoric listening to it. I listen to it sometimes when I'm coming home from work, when I'm fucking beat, and it just gets me going. And when I say I get euphoric on the song, I actually was on Euphoria when I listened to it, but I think it was the song. No, I'm totally kidding. Euphoria, whatever. It's got one of the greatest uses of the ride cymbal on the damn thing. It's just solid-ass session musicians. And it's funny, I remember I was working with a guy who was a drummer, and I was editing, and I was playing Feels So Good, the amazing 1977 Chuck Mangione instrumental song. And this guy came by as I was playing, and he's like, that's the most devastating use of the ride cymbal ever, which is totally true. If you listen to Feels So Good, it's just perfect and pro. And also on that Rocky theme, too, totally amazing ride cymbal use. Proper like ride cymbal use is just, it's just an old school thing back when people knew what the fuck they were doing. And randomly, I just found kind of a funny quote from the author Anne Lamott. She said, if people wanted you to write warmly about them, they should have behaved better. So funny, so witty. And I do hope people write warmly about me if they write about me at all. And speaking of authors, when my mom and I were coming back after nursing school, we stopped in Ketchum, Idaho, famously the town where the boozing, brawling Ernest Hemingway killed himself in 1961 when he was 61 years old, famously shot himself with a shotgun. We stopped off at the graveyard, too, and saw Ernest Hemingway's grave and also his granddaughter's grave, the troubled model actress Margot Hemingway, spelled M-A-R-G-A-U-X. She suffered from depression and used some drugs and stuff, and she died of an overdose in 1996 in Santa Monica. Margot Hemingway and her sister, the much more famous Mariel Hemingway, both were famously in this pretty sleazy 1976 thriller called Lipstick, where one of them gets raped, and it's kind of a revenge movie. There's just always been something very dirty about that movie, and I'm not pretty comfortable with it. And so anyway, when I was up there, I did some sleuthing online, and I found the street address to where Ernest Hemingway famously shot himself to death. My mom stayed in the hotel. She had no interest. And so I was driving up to it, and you have to pass over this little entrance, and it's got all these fucking signs and cameras, do not enter a private road, people can be prosecuted type shit. And I just stood there for quite a while. You could kind of see a few houses down there. Probably actually saw which one was his house. But I just didn't drive down there. I usually don't give a damn about stuff like that. Like in LA, if there's a private road, I'm like, fuck it. I'm going up it. What are they going to do? Give me a ticket or something? It's almost like Sharon Stone when she lights up a cigarette during Basic Instinct says, what are you going to do? Arrest me for smoking? But anyway, I don't know Idaho, man. So I was like, I'm not going to fuck around here. Maybe they got different rules here. I know Los Angeles, but shit, who knows? So yeah, I didn't see it. And I kind of was pissed that I didn't go up that damn road. If I'm ever up there again, I will. Anyway, supposedly the author Hunter S. Thompson visited the house and took some kind of antlers or something off one of the walls. I think it became like a writer's retreat or something for people to stay in, or it's kind of like, I know, a historic monument or whatever the fuck they call those. Anyway, speaking of Ernest Hemingway, Mr. Badass himself, George C. Scott, starred in the 1977 movie adaptation of the book Islands in the Stream, directed by, once again, the patent director Franklin J. Schaffner. And as mentioned before, both George C. Scott and Franklin Schaffner are buried at Pierce Brothers Cemetery in Westwood. George C.'s is unmarked, but Franklin J. Schaffner's is marked. But anyway, the movie based on the Hemingway book, Islands in the Stream, it's about aging and fatherhood. It's a little slow and dated, but you can never deny the brilliance of George C. Scott. And of course, we always think of the song Islands in the Stream when we hear that. The famous song by Dolly Parton and the gambler himself, Kenny Rogers. Here's a little taste of that. Islands in the stream, that is what we are. No one in between, how can we be wrong? Sail away with me to another world, and we'll rely on each other, uh-huh. From one lover to another, uh-huh. In And on the same trip, the penultimate stop, I think that's the correct use of the word, anyway, was the strangely named Winnemucca, Nevada. Me and my mom were starting to get on each other's nerves. This was like day four or five of the trip. I was still vaping at the time. It was irritable as fuck. But we had the best damn Mexican food there. It was so unexpected and just like heavenly good. So if you're ever in Winnemucca, please find a Mexican restaurant, because I don't remember the title. I don't remember the name of it, but anyway, never forget it. But yeah, let's end this one with a couple quotes from the tough as nails, Ernest Hemingway. When I'm feeling real low, sometimes I see his quotes and I honestly picture George C. Scott kind of barking out the lines at me. And it kind of lifts my spirits in a bit. Also scares me, but at least kind of gets me like, okay, let's fucking do this. I like this one from 1952's The Old Man and the Sea, which was also a classic 1958 movie with the legend himself, Spencer Tracy, and the big-time John Sturges directed, who also just did the utter classics Bad Day at Black Rock in 1955, also with Spencer Tracy, and The Magnificent Seven from 1960, and The Fucking Great Escape from 1963 with the cool as hell Steve McQueen, James Garner, Charles Bronson, and just a murderous row of actors starring Allied prisoners at war in a POW camp. But there's just so many classic scenes, including a memorable and great-looking scene with Steve McQueen riding on a motorcycle. Steve McQueen ended up dying of cancer. I think he kind of went to Mexico, actually, and tried this Laetrile crap, L-A-E-T-R-I-L-E. I think it's also known as like vitamin B17. I think it's made from apricot seeds or something like that. Supposedly not effective. And obviously it didn't work for him. But anyway, the theme of The Great Escape, it's so fucking memorable. They like whistling it, I think. But it's kind of like just like bump, 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 bump. Bum 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 bum, something like that anyway. But anyway, the quote from The Old Man and the Sea is, but man is not made for defeat. Man can be destroyed, but not defeated. So if I do get destroyed, just remember I wasn't defeated, goddammit. Couple others. Courage is grace under pressure. And of course, I'm not talking about Under Pressure, the song by David Bowie and Freddie Mercury, so famously sampled by Vanilla Ice for his song Ice Ice Baby. And anyway, from 1929's A Farewell to Arms, which was used so well in the Evil Dead movie when Ash, played by Bruce Campbell, his hand gets possessed and he grabs the book A Farewell to Arms at some point. Ash ends up cutting off his hand to destroy the kind of, you know, demon or evil inside. It's just such a fucking clever scene. But anyway, one of the great quotes of all time. The world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong at the broken places.